This show is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network, the Justice League of board game podcasts. Find out more at Dicetower.com.
Welcome to another episode of the Family Gamers Podcast. This is episode 224.
Hello, hello, everybody. We are super excited to be with you again. You know, honey, I really feel like it's been a while since we podcasted, even though we do this every week. For some reason, it just feels like it's been a while.
Maybe because the last two were easier and we didn't have to really think hard about a topic?
I have no idea. Well, hello, everybody. This is the Family Gamers Podcast. As always, I am your host, Andrew, and I am joined by my lovely and wonderful wife, Anitra.
That's me.
And it is episode 224. Unsurprisingly enough, I have not one, but two facts.
Two facts.
About the number 224. So the first one is kind of a silly fact. It turns out that patents of class 224, the 224 class of patents, pertains to clothing that you would wear that you would attach something to or that would hold something. So like belt loops that you would, you know, put a belt through, or like the loops that you would put like a coat pull.
Okay.
Right? Those loops would be like class 224 patent related stuff, or like a shop apron or a bib.
Okay.
Those would be
weird
things that would be patented under class 224. The other fact is a little bit shorter. Baseball player, baseball pitcher, Catfish Hunter, who's got a cool name.
That's a cool name.
Which is why I'm bringing it up. Had 224 career wins.
All right. Not bad.
The biggest thing that I found was that it's another class of ammunition, but we just talked about ammunition last week. Nobody wants to talk about that kind of stuff too much. So We're not going to talk about that anymore. However, what we are going to talk about is our sponsor, First Move Financial. So let's face it, life, real life, is a resource management game. In fact, the federal government is learning that right now with trying to allocate these vaccines, which were just freshly approved. Us, we have so much fun sitting around the table and plotting the use of resources in games like Power Grid or Terraforming Mars. Why is it so stressful in real life to manage our resources? It doesn't necessarily have to be. Resource management in real life follows many of the same principles, but because we're in it, it's harder to see. It actually helps to have an outside advisor in those cases, and that's what First Move Financial can do for you. For expert help in applying some of the same principles that help you take down your friends in Agricola, not Agricola, by the way, head over to firstmovefinancial.com/familygamers today to schedule a call.
Thanks again to First Move Financial for sponsoring this episode of the podcast.
So this week, we are absolutely drowning in a deluge of
dice games.
Dice games. So we looked back on when we last did like a top five dice games podcast, and it turned out it was episode 66.
It was episode 66. It was like 4 years ago.
That's a long time ago. And so as we kind of started to talk about like what would a top five dice game podcast look like, we realized that every single game that was on our list kind of represented other kinds of games as well. And so what we thought we would do is look at how dynamic this deluge of dice games could be.
Go a little easy on the alliteration there.
The duh-alliteration?
I'll deliterate you.
Uh-oh.
But first, as always, we're going to talk about what we've been playing.
You got it. Yeah, I have been playing a lot of games, which for me is like 8 games in 2 weeks. That's a lot for me these days with my life.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I say 8, I mean 8 different games. Like if I play a game back to back, I usually only record it as one.
Okay.
So, but the first one on my list is The Bears and the Bees. We played this a little bit over a week ago, getting ready for our Snap review, which we released last week.
Mm-hmm.
Where I sound like a very silly bear.
I love it.
So The Bears and the Bees is a game from Grandpa Beck's Games. I do recommend going to thefamilygamers.com and checking out the Snap review for that. It's a really nice laid-back tile-laying matching game, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those games where your goal is to empty your hand of cards and to do it before anybody else can.
Yeah, it's cute and fun. And again, you probably head over to thefamilygamers.com to check that out.
We played something seasonally appropriate. We tried Christmas Lights, a card game from 25th Century Games.
Yeah, this was a really interesting game. It reminded me a lot of Hanabi.
Yeah, except it was competitive instead of cooperative. You are trying to set out a string of Christmas lights using cards from your hand, but you have to set them out in the right order. And there's a bunch of different things you can do on your turn that'll let you either swap a card with somebody or sell off some of your cards to ask questions about the other cards that are still in your hand. It was really interesting. It did not go over really well, but I think that's partly because we were learning the game and we pulled in Elliot, the six-year-old, on the first game when we were learning, which of course made it take like three times as long.
Yeah, why do we do that?
Honestly, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But it was a lot of fun to play, and I'm looking forward to playing it again, especially since, like you said, it is in fact seasonally appropriate.
For what it's worth, the game comes with an extra rule book with a whole bunch of other games you can play. And for about a week afterwards, Asher was teaching himself all of the various other games that you could play with it, including one or two solo games.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of neat.
Yeah, I think it's probably like the shining feature of the game is that in a really small box, you get so much replayability, which mm-hmm. is really nice. So another game that we got most of the family together to play was Fiver Find In, a favorite.
Yay! And our daughter wiped the floor with us.
She demolished us. If you head over to our Instagram page, which is at FamilyGamersAA, you can see the adorable 12-year-old smirking at us because she wiped the floor with us.
It was a good time, though. Same day we played Fiver Findin', we tried out Cloud Control from 25th Century Games. That was a really neat game. And by the way, the 12-year-old wiped the floor with us on that one too, even though she had to leave halfway through.
Yeah, that's how embarrassing this one was.
That was embarrassing.
Cloud Control is a game that is a lot like Imagine from Game Right. They're very similar games. Cloud Control is constructed in essentially two rounds, and there's kind of a middle, like, halftime show game in the middle of it. And Claire had to head off to school because we did it earlier in the morning. She had to head off to class, her Zoom class, halfway through the game. So we continued the game and played through the rest of it and then tallied up our points, and she still won.
Yeah.
So that was great. That was just great.
Cloud Control was a neat game, though. It's kind of like a Pictionary or a Charades, using these cards with cloud shapes on them to make your assigned word. You can animate your clouds by moving them around if you want, which can help sometimes. And it was just a really neat twist on it. And it worked out really well as sort of a right after breakfast, right before school game for our family.
Yeah, it was nice. It wasn't too deep to get into or anything like that. The hardest part is laying out all of the different tiles that you can grab and use to create your shapes. I mean, if that's the hardest part, you're probably okay.
I think so.
Yeah. The next day, Asher and I played a two-player game of Dungeon Drop. So this is a game that we've had in our review queue for a little while. This is a really interesting and unique game. It really has some mechanics that I've never seen before. Have you played Dungeon Drop?
I have, but not for a little while.
So the main gimmick, I guess, to Dungeon Drop is that you start the game by taking a certain set of these cubes. These small cubes are like, I don't know, a quarter of the height and depth and width of a normal six-sided die. They're very small. And you have a certain handful of them and you drop them. And all the different colored cubes all mean different things. And so at the beginning of your turn, you take some more cubes out, a certain number, and you drop them into the dungeon. And then you create a triangle with imaginary lines between three of the pillars, which are the gray cubes.
Mm-hmm.
You pick up everything that's inside of that. If they're a certain color, which means creatures, you take damage, essentially. If they're gold, you get points. If they're a couple of different things, you get different abilities from them. And you kind of go around in a circle, and there's a little bit of like set collection-y kind of stuff and some bonus stuff, and you have a secret objective. It's really a different kind of game. There's nothing that I can possibly compare this to.
Yeah, it's not a dexterity game. It's not something where the cards or the dice or anything like that are providing the randomness. Instead, it's the dropping of the components onto the play surface that's providing the randomness of your setup.
Which is really, really interesting. So with a game like this, number one, I would recommend do not play this on a hard table without some kind of pad. What we actually did, this was recommended to me by a friend of mine, was we got an empty pizza box.
Yeah, we've played in an empty pizza box. If, like us, you're ordering a lot of things online these days, I will say that the box our special cat food comes in also works really well.
Yeah, it's like a it's kind of a tray kind of thing. So like if you go to craft beer places and you get, you know, 24 beers, it would be one of those kinds of trays.
Yeah.
Yep. So those would work pretty well too. You don't want to use a standard cardboard box which has flaps on the inside because
that's
really
not so good.
Want a flat surface. But it's a really interesting game. This is a Game Right game, so it's fairly inexpensive. I don't know that it's like, you know, top of my list, this game is totally amazing, but it's certainly unique and it's very easy to understand. There is a little bit of reading involved.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a tiny bit of dexterity. Like if you do certain things, you can flick some cubes, but it's not like you're trying to aim at something. You're just kind of getting them out of the way.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. So that's Dungeon Drop from Phase Shift Games and Game Right. It was an interesting game to play.
Asher and I played some more of Unmatched, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I think I've tried everybody except Willow and Tara at this point, which are the only ranged fighters in the set.
So I also played some Unmatched, and I played with Spike, and I played with Angel. And I don't know what I did wrong with Spike, but I was terrible with him.
I'm sorry.
Was fine with Angel. Angel is a much more offensive character. So I think you mentioned Buffy when we had Isaac and Ryan on the show. You mentioned that you played the Buffy set, and you played with Buffy, who is just like, I hit things, and I hit them a lot. And when I played as Spike, I think I was playing against Asher using Buffy. Not only does Buffy hit a lot, but she's also faster than every other character in the set.
Yeah, she is.
And it was just impossible. I just couldn't do anything. So I won one, and then I lost one. I won with Angel, and I lost with Spike.
Fair enough. These things happen. I'm still kind of working my way through trying to figure out how all of the Buffy characters are balanced. I'm not sure what you were doing with Asher, but the problem I always run into with Buffy is that it's really easy to run out of cards. So the key, if you're playing against Buffy, is not to always run away, because then Buffy has to maneuver to catch up with you. And every time Buffy maneuvers, of course, she can get cards. So it's more about sucking a bunch of hits and then making it so that Buffy can't get cards.
Sure. I mean, the good thing about Unmatched is that the game moves super quick and you can play it a lot. And I'm sure we will play it more.
All right.
So, speaking of playing games with my gaming buddy, you and I and Asher sat down and played a game of Tidal Blades.
This was a really cool game.
Okay, so first of all, a couple days earlier, Asher and I sat down to try to play a game of Tidal Blades, and we made it about a round and a half into this game, which is a four-round game, and it was just so overwhelming, and there was so much going on, and I was really starting from scratch, and Asher had played the game before, but he's 9 years old.
He had played the game like a year and a half ago.
A year ago. It was PAX Unplugged.
Yeah, at a convention with somebody, you know, walking him through what all his options
were. Exactly. So it was pretty overwhelming to try to understand everything that was going on. Plus, because we were playing with two players, there was also an Automa third player. You have to have three, I guess, for the way this thing works out. And that third player had slightly different rules, and since we didn't have a really good handle on the main rules of the game, adding that third player mechanic thing and was just weird. I don't know. But anyway, so we got most of the kinks worked out. We watched how to play video afterward just to basically confirm what we thought we knew and check things that we weren't quite sure about. So we went through that, and then we sat down with Mom and played with Mom.
Yeah, then you pulled me in, and it was a good time, and I'm really looking forward to playing it again. I think it'll go faster now that we all understand it.
It'll be helpful when we get all of the skill from fighting things in the Fold,
too. Yay! But let me tell you, there is a lot of setup for this game.
There's a lot going on.
There's a lot of setup. I wish there was a little bit less fiddly, like, this has to go here, and this has to go here, and everything has to be set up exactly right.
You know, I mean, there are some interesting questions around that. Like, why did they choose to make it separate pieces of board instead
of... Yeah, like a modular board, except...
It's a modular board, but you always put the pieces in the same place.
Yeah, I don't know.
So I'm not really sure about that. I don't know if they felt like it was maybe a little bit more cost effective or something. Maybe they could have had all of the board except for one piece, or I don't really know. But it's, I mean, it added a little bit to the setup time. There's just a lot. There's just a lot in there. And again, we had an absolute blast playing it, and we will play it again. But like, this is a game where, I mean, we have to set aside an hour and a half to play, which is not that bad, but everybody's got to be engaged, which they should be. I mean, these are all, you know, things that you should, you know, kind of be doing, but you really have to be paying attention the whole time that you play.
Yeah, it's a big part of why we don't tend to play heavier games as a family because Claire, our 12-year-old, is generally not interested, and we have an agent of chaos still. He's not going to just pull stuff randomly off the table, but he's going to be like, oh, hey, everybody else is distracted. I can go make a giant mess of Legos or go do a bunch of screen time or do things I'm not supposed to. So that makes it hard to focus on playing a game.
Yeah, I mean, we want to have him in the room when we're doing something as a family, even if he can't do the thing that we're doing. Like, look, Tidal Blades is not a heavy game. There's just, and that's kind of the hard thing to explain. It's not that it's complicated. There's just a lot of pieces.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things to think about and remember and contemplate and whatever. And again, going through it in this kind of iterative fashion, it certainly is smoothing out those bumps every time we play it. Mm-hmm, and I would like to play it more, but it's just something to be aware of. That's all. On the complete other side of the spectrum, we pulled another 25th Century Games game off the shelf in Winner Winner Chicken Dinner.
Okay, this was cute.
Did you end up playing it as well? Or
I did.
You played it afterwards? Okay. So number one, there is a rubber chicken in the box that does absolutely nothing other than make rubber chicken noises and make little boys laugh.
I mean, they basically tell you in the rules, use it for whatever purposes you see fit. There are cards when you're playing with three or more players that are things like have a chicken dance-off contest or a chicken cluck-off contest, and you are allowed to grab the rubber chicken for assistance in either of those.
Oh my goodness gracious. I don't even know if I could emotionally handle that.
No, but it's fun. It's Winner Winner Chicken Dinner is this game where you're trying to collect chickens from the chicken coop because you're a fox, and so you want a chicken dinner. You're also trying to take chickens from your own collection and cook them, because then they're worth more points and nobody can steal them from you. They can still steal the chickens from you when they're alive. It sounds a little morbid when you put it that way, but it's just ridiculous fun of, you know, oh, well, I'm going to roll the dice and, oh, hey, look at all these chickens I got. Or I'm going to roll the dice and, oh, now I get this other benefit and you have to put a bunch of chickens back. It was a lot of fun. I think we're going to play it plenty more times with plenty of laughter.
Yep, I totally agree. Yeah, this is an interesting game. I like the fact that there were a lot of different game end conditions, which is not necessarily the same thing as win conditions.
Yeah, like the dog can get to the end of a certain little score track, or you can run out of chicken tokens for people to take, and either one of those will end the game, but neither one of them is really a, oh, hey, if you did this thing, then you win.
Right, exactly.
You have to dump out the bags of chicken and find out who won.
Yep. And when I played with Elliot, our six-year-old, he won. So
yeah, I bet he enjoyed that.
Yeah, I'm sure he loved it quite a bit. So that was Winner Winner Chicken Dinner from 25th Century Games.
A couple more real simple ones that we've been playing lately is some Shifting Stones.
Love that game.
Which we're going to put the snap review for that in the break in the show.
Yes, we are. That was our number five game of the year.
It sure was. And I've also been playing some Dragomino with the kids. Dragomino is also billed as My First King Domino. And like some other games that are billed as My First, it's kind of a four-year-old can play King Domino. But Dragomino is really cute, and it is definitely simpler and easier for kids to understand. But it's not so simple that I feel dumb as an adult to play it.
It's not like you're wasting your time or gritting your teeth through a game to play it with a child.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't necessarily pull it out to play with other adults, but I would pull it out and play it with like our 12-year-old and not feel dumb for doing it.
Sure.
So it's fun.
Mm-hmm. I have two more games on my list. Both of them are games that you've played. I know that because one of them I played with you. But the first one is a game that we got as a gift. It was an early Christmas present. This was Professor Evil and the Citadel of Time.
I thought it was Poofessor Evil.
Well, we called him the Poofessor because he kept beating us up or following after us and kicking us out of his mansion and flipping all the switches and locking all the doors. So this is a game that I have seen for a long time, and it's kind of been tantalizingly out of my reach in the sense that, you know, I just couldn't swing the $25 or whatever it was to buy it at any given time. It just wasn't enough of a want, you know, to make it worth it.
Mm-hmm.
So Professor Evil and the Citadel of Time is basically like, if you love Ghost Fight and Treasure Hunters, which a lot of us do, this is kind of like the next step up. I mean, it really feels like a spiritual successor kind of thing, even though to my knowledge, none of the people involved in the development have anything to do with each other. But how do you feel about it? Because we didn't play together, but I really feel like this is that game, but up a level.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities there. You're coming into a mansion. You're looking for treasures that you're trying to rescue out of the mansion.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, it's a lot more dynamic, I guess, than Ghost Fighting Treasure Hunters. In your search for the treasures, you have to disarm various traps to be able to get a treasure. And so you're flipping switches and you're unlocking doors to get where you need to go. And the problem is this Professor Evil is also wandering around his mansion. And every time he walks into a room, he locks all the doors behind him again. He flips everything back on again and just continues to make your job really hard. There's also a central clock with sort of a countdown for every treasure that's currently on the board. And so you're also racing against time, that the longer you go, the more chance you're going to have that the treasure is going to slip out of your grasp. And if four treasures slip by before you've managed to rescue four treasures, then you lose.
So I really like how you have to manage all of these different things. Everybody plays as their own character, and they have asymmetric character abilities as well, which is kind of interesting. So it definitely is more complicated than Ghost Fight and Treasure Hunters, but again, I really feel like it's kind of the next step up. I don't know how much the game costs normally on retail because it was given to us as a gift, but I don't recall it being particularly expensive.
Well, it was a lot of fun, and we're definitely going to be playing it more soon.
I do not regret asking for it as a gift.
That's for sure.
Let me put you like that. And the last game on my list is a game called Athenium Mystic Library. So this is a game from Renegade Games. It's a brand new game, just came out maybe a couple of weeks ago. And I really like the look of this game. I was really intrigued by what I saw in the kind of the write-ups and all this other stuff. And so when we got it in and we sat down and we started to play it, I realized that I really, really, really like the spatial puzzle of this game.
Yeah, this whole idea that you are magic students and you're cramming for your exams and the librarian is going to help you, but only if you organize the books, is ridiculous, but it works with the theme.
So when we played this game, I mean, at this point in our lives, we are always thinking about games with a review mindset. What do I like? What do I not like? What are the kind of unique takes that I have on this game or whatever? One of the first things that struck me about Athenium is that even though there's tons of pieces and you have all these book spines that you're organizing on your board, even though you have all of this stuff, the game really takes up a small amount of space on the table.
Yeah, it was kind of nice, actually.
It was almost weird. I was like, there's a lot of junk on the table, and we can still fit this game in the middle of it without a problem. There really wasn't much. There's no flip-out board. The board is the size of the box, or a little bit smaller than the box. You could put the board on top of the box and then have your little play area in front of you, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, that's just about it. There's a couple of little bins for all your different kinds of books that you could grab.
But they're self-contained bins. They even gave us bins. I will say I wish that they gave us covers for the bins like Ecos does, which was a nice thing that they did. But, I mean, that's so nitpicky.
At least they give us bins.
They give us bins, exactly. So, yeah. So this is a game where you're getting these kind of goal cards that come out and you need to arrange your books so that they fit the requirements on the goal cards, which are usually like orientations of books. And once you achieve one of those, you can put a wand on a goal to indicate that you've completed that goal. You get those victory points. There's also bonus tiles that you can pull that either put candles on top of your bookcase that can be worth points, or you can get extra like auxiliary bookcases. So you could put more books on it, but the game progresses pretty quickly. So it's not like you're going to spend a ton of stuff like building out this grand bookcase in front of you. You've got your one bookcase. Pretty much you could go through the entire game just filling your one bookcase up.
Probably. So it's also a card drafting game. That's the main mechanic of how you get these books to put on your shelves, is that you have a hand of cards, you're taking one, and then you're going to pass the hand to the next player. But within that drafting, every card actually has three sections on it, and it's the award that you, the player, get. And then the other two sections are the award that the player on your left gets and the award that the player on your right gets. This makes for a really interesting dynamic because not only are you drafting, but you're drafting in a way where you're directly responsible for what other players are going to get. Not just because you're passing them a hand of cards, but you're literally playing the card that will give them a benefit. it definitely affected our play late in the game, as we said, well, I want this, but I really don't want you to get that. So I'm going to play this a different way instead. And hopefully you'll play the card that I'm avoiding playing, and then I'll get the benefit.
Yeah, yeah. And then at the end of that game, I took one look at you and I learned where Claire got her 12-year-old smirk.
Hey!
Because you pasted me. I think your score was literally 50% more than my score in that game. I really enjoyed it. I obviously played poorly. I learned some things strategically after scoring. I should have done differently.
These things happen.
Yeah.
It's definitely the kind of game where the scoring mechanics made sense to me right away. And I always do better first play with games like that. I think on subsequent plays, we'll be a lot closer in score.
One can only hope, at least for my sake.
I do hope for your sake. I've only got two more. I took a day off from homeschooling.
You sinner.
I'm terrible. I asked Asher on our rare day alone, just the two of us, what game he would like to play. And I said, I'll pick a game, you pick a game. So he thought and thought and thought and thought for a long time, staring at the shelves, and then picked Dice Forge with an expansion. That was pretty cool. Adding in an expansion, actually playing through the expansion was fun and not that different than playing Dice Forge, but trying to figure out how to set up for the expansion, not really.
We've had this expansion for over a year, I think, and I don't think we've played it at all.
This might be the first time we've played.
I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah. So glad it got out there, at least.
It's two variations in one box, and you can't use them both at the same time. So first we had to pick one, and then we had to figure out what was involved. We did have a lot of fun with it. It did definitely add more to the game, but not in an overwhelming way. So that was nice. I really like, still, that Dice Forge die building.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where you get to peel faces off and put new faces on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, so that was great. And I lied. I didn't completely take the day off from homeschooling because my choice was Discoveries, the Journals of Lewis and Clark.
Which I love. I love that game so much.
Which is a great game and ties in very nicely with the fact that we've just started a chapter in our social studies book about the westward expansion from the original 13 colonies.
There you go.
So he learned a little bit. We are going to play that game a couple more times over the next week while we're still in that chapter.
Yeah, I want to be homeschooled.
I know, right? But no, we're having a really good time with it. It took me a little while to remember how to play the game, but this is another game that uses a bunch of dice, and I think we both had a lot of fun with it. We were tied. We were tied up until the second tiebreaker, and very we got impressive. There by very different routes, so it felt like a really good game.
It was good. I liked it a lot. Good for Asher for tying Mom.
Yeah. I mean, on his first game, no less.
Yeah, absolutely. There you go.
So I think that's it. We are going to take a little break, give you our snap review for Shifting Stones. Mm-hmm. And when we come back, we will talk about all different kinds of ways to use dice in games. But before we do that, we will talk about our giveaway winner.
That's right. We are giving away a copy of My First Castle Panic. Not just a copy, but our very own copy that, sadly, our youngest has grown out of.
Aw.
Bum, bum, bum. We'll be right back. A mysterious grid of 9 ancient stones lies before you. Rearrange these intricately cut stones to match your pattern cards and score points. The challenge is that cards may either be used to manipulate the stones or score points, but never both. Score the most points, win the game.
This is a snap review for Shifting Stones. Shifting Stones is a puzzle game for 1-5 players by J. Evan Raitt. It's best for players 8 and up, takes about 15 minutes, and it's published by Game Right.
We need to start talking about Shifting Stones by talking about how gorgeous this game is. The 9 chunky cardboard tiles are the focus of Shifting Stones. Although the game would be just as playable if they were solid colors, they are beautifully illustrated by Quan Chai Moria and elevate this game considerably.
The tiles have an embossed texture that follows the art on them. There are also small, irregular indents along each side, which make them easy to grip and flip over, and also make them look more like real stone.
Illustrations also serve as a secondary aid to memory when flipping the tiles. A white seed becomes a green tree, the black moon becomes the yellow sun. The cards used to score plays use pictures of the tiles, and sometimes gray spaces to indicate positioning within the 9-tile grid, and they're easy to understand and they don't really require any reading.
So Asher, let's talk about how you play Shifting Stones now that we've talked about how pretty it is.
Playing Shifting Stones once you know how to is very, very simple. On your turn, you play your cards one at a time, and you can either discard a card from your hand to either swap two adjacent stones or flip a stone, or put out a card from your hand that matches the current layout to score points.
If you can't score and you don't want to play any of the cards in your hand, you may pass instead to draw an additional two cards. When your turn is over, draw your hand back up to four cards.
And that's it. That's the game. Players take turns until someone has scored some number of cards. It depends on how many players there are in the game. Finish the round so that everyone gets the same number of turns, and then add up your cards that you've scored. So first, let's talk about some expectations. Even though we've only had Shifting Stones in our home for a couple of weeks, we actually saw it over a year ago at the Boston Festival of Indie Games, a convention near us. The brightly colored tiles really stood out against the black tablecloth, and there wasn't any other decoration really needed. The shifting and flipping mechanics are immediately understandable. It takes 5 seconds to explain.
It's hard to part with cards that are so close to being able to score, but you'll have to make the hard decisions and discard some in order to score others.
Maybe the other players will move the stones into the positions you need, or maybe they'll move them farther away. You can't plan too far ahead.
Personally, I love abstract games, and I love games that have multiple use cards. I think Shifting Stones does both of these things very well.
Shifting Stones does a great job capturing the tension between getting to your goal and being really close to your goal. And it creates this tantalizing feeling of almost getting to exactly where you want to be, but not quite getting there. It's a great feeling in a game.
It really is. It makes you want to keep playing. All right, now let's talk about what surprised us in Shifting Stones.
So in the rules, it says that everyone needs to work on the grid in the same orientation. That means that all of the players have to agree on which side of the grid is the top, which can be annoying because, let's face it, usually you're not all sitting in a line when you're playing a game. We recommend trying to sit side by side, though, or directly across from each other, so at least you can hold your cards upside down. This was kind of frustrating to me. I don't really see a good reason why it has to be this way. There's really no reason why different people can't just have their own perspectives. We see that in other games all the time.
Yeah, I agree.
I was super surprised that there's a solo mode for this game.
You love solo modes.
I do. This one was very interesting. You create a smaller deck, and then you try to score every card in the deck before you earn 4 strikes, being a turn when you can't score.
I was really surprised that there's literally no reading required, well, except for the rules. So young kids who can't really read well yet can still play the game, but they just might not plan very well.
Well, I'll talk about a pleasant surprise, which is we've already seen you and your little brother who can't read yet playing this game without mom or dad involved. And we really like that.
That's not true.
So that's it. That's Shifting Stones from Game Right. Asher, what do you think we'll rate this tile-shifting puzzle game?
I think we'll rate it 5 stone tiles out of 5.
All right.
And that's Shifting Stones
in a snap. And we're back from our break. So the first thing that we are going to do before we get into our topic this week is to talk about our giveaway. So we are giving away our copy of My First Castle Panic from Fireside Games. This was actually our copy of My First Castle Panic. It's almost like giving away a beloved blanket or something like that. This is the copy that our son Elliot, who is now 6, played when he was 4. Castle Panic already is a pretty simple game. We've talked about this a little bit on the show. We reviewed the game as well. Castle Panic is a pretty simple cooperative game that we recommend as a gateway cooperative game for families. And this brings it down to an even more consumable level for younger ages.
Yeah, My First Castle Panic is really, really good for kids ages 3, 4, 5 who really aren't ready for reading and aren't ready for a game that's going to take, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes. My first castle panic takes about 15 minutes, and it's just about matching colors and symbols. But you do begin to learn a little bit of sequencing and being able to think a step or two ahead.
Right, and it's fantastic. It can be played basically as a solo game or as a cooperative game. Elliot would take the game out and set it up, and we would come out in the morning, and he would be sitting there on the living room floor playing it. Super adorable. Very cute game. Unfortunately for everybody except for one person who entered the contest, you are going to have to go out and pick up a copy of the game, but it is inexpensive. It's a great gift for the burgeoning gamer in your life.
It definitely is, especially if said burgeoning gamer has big brothers and big sisters that they really want to play games like, and they're just not quite ready yet.
Yeah, this is a game that older kids can certainly play, and they won't feel like they're being forced to play, I don't know, Candyland. So without further ado, we have picked the winner of this giveaway, and the winner is...
Sarah Parikh.
Congratulations, Sarah. We're so glad that you chose to subscribe to the Family Gamers newsletter. There's lots of great stuff that goes out on that when Anitra has time to put a newsletter together.
Yeah.
If you are interested in the Family Gamers newsletter, you can head over to thefamilygamers.com/newsletter and sign up. Sometimes, we've done this before, we've given things away on the newsletter that we haven't announced on the show.
Yeah, we don't tell anybody.
Nobody.
Else. It's a secret.
Yep. So, head over there, do that. Otherwise, there's lots of other ways you can get a hold of us at FamilyGamersAA on all of the social. And that's it.
Congratulations again.
Yeah, absolutely. So, now let's talk about some dice.
Dice, dice, baby.
Maybe that should be the name of the show.
That was the name of episode 66.
Oh, well... Never mind that. All right. You know, again, we mentioned this at the top of the show. We started talking about doing another top five dice games kind of show. The last one we did was 160 almost episodes ago. But really, the more we talked about it, the more we kind of wanted to just talk about dice in general. I think back to our friend Joe Cummings, Art of Board Gaming, who absolutely despises dice as chance cubes as the primary driver in games. And I kind of was thinking about that, and I was thinking about some other stuff, and really I just wanted to talk about dice as potentially the most versatile element in board gaming.
Yeah, I can't think of another element other than maybe cards that you can use in so many different ways. You can use them, obviously, as chance cubes to randomize things. You can use them as counters. You can use them as workers or indicators. You can use them as a building tool and stack them on each other. Mm-hmm. I used to play a game back when I was in high school that involved stacking dice. There's a lot you can do.
Absolutely, absolutely. So what I thought we might do is kind of touch on some of these fusion categories, meta categories, whatever we want to call them, and our favorites in each of those, kind of.
All right, or at least ones we think exemplify that category.
Represent
well.
It well, yeah. So the first one, we're going to go all the way back, and we're going to talk about Dice Throne.
Okay, so Dice Throne, aka Battle Yahtzee.
Yep, Battle Yahtzee.
It's a combat game.
It is, and you know, we've been playing a lot of combat games lately. We've been talking about how Asher is kind of getting into Magic the Gathering a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot about Dice Throne that feels like Magic the Gathering in the sense of a back and forth battle where you're dealing damage to each other and trying to defend and these kinds of things. It really feels like that. But at the same time, it's a set collection game.
Yeah, so there are other combat games that use dice, but the idea that you have to line up those dice into specific sets to get the effect you want kind of makes Dice Throne stand out.
Well, the big thing about it is that there's no aspect to the dice of roll this die for a higher number and deal that amount of damage kind
right,
of thing.
Right, exactly.
And that's the thing that's very different about Dice Throne and the way that Dice Throne approaches battle in a game centered around dice, but not using dice in that conventional way.
Right, and as we mentioned in, I think, our last Play This Not That, when we mentioned Yahtzee, if you like the set collection but don't really like the battle idea of Dice Throne, Roll For It is another excellent set collection dice game. This is one where you get to set the dice aside, try to save them for later, and hope that somebody else doesn't get that set first.
So let's talk about our next topic here, which is spatial puzzles. This is one where you and I both have our favorites, which are very, very different, and yet in reality, actually kind of similar.
They look very similar. These are Sagrada and Role Player.
Right. I mean, they look similar in the fact that they are spatial puzzles that use dice.
You put dice in a grid.
But they're very different.
Yes. In Sagrada, you're trying to create specific patterns, and you're not allowed to do things like have dice of the same value touching or have dice of the same color touching. None of those kind of restrictions exist in Role Player. Instead, you're trying to get certain values on the dice in certain rows and certain colors in certain spots in your grid.
So there's a little bit of moving those dice back and forth and jockeying for position kind of thing on your own board. So there's a lot of dice manipulation in Role Player.
Yeah, and there's very little dice manipulation in Sagrada, unless you're using some expansion that I haven't seen.
Just to kind of talk about these games a little bit. So in Role Player, if you have played RPGs and you have ever played a game of D&D, you probably know that your first session of Dungeons & Dragons is really just making your character. That's what you do. Right.
And usually it's called rolling up your character.
Yes, rolling up your character. Well, Role Player took that first session and just turned that into the entire game. And so what you are doing in a game of Role Player is drafting dice out of a center area. And as you draft those dice, if you draft a more desirable die, a higher face value die, you're getting a lower order in the purchasing queue for the market. So if you take the lowest die, you're going to be able to purchase first. Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this whole set collection thing around armor and skills and feats and stuff in the market. But the primary driver of how everything works is in the dice that you draft and put on your character board for your character's attributes.
And don't forget, when you put dice on the character board, a lot of those specific rows and spots then allow you to do something to manipulate other dice on the board.
Right. So there's a lot of min-maxing going on in this game. There's a lot of individual moving parts. And then the expansions even add on to this even more. So the Monsters and Minions expansion allows you to fight creatures if you don't want to go to the market or do other things. And then there's main enemies at the end of the game. The Fiends and Familiars expansion, which just came out this year, allows you to have a familiar, which kind of helps you along on your mission. And there's all these extra things. There actually is a Role Player Adventures RPG coming out that you will be able to use the character that you made while playing the game Role Player.
And on and on and on.
And so on and so forth, right? But at its core, Role Player is a spatial puzzle. We talked about that with Athenium,
mm-hmm.
how much I like spatial puzzles.
Yes.
And that's why I just really, really love Role Player so much. Role Player is the game that I've acquired the most bling for, I think is the right term.
The most extra stuff.
Yes.
So Sagrada is also a spatial puzzle with dice, but it gets rid of all that min-maxing and most of the dice manipulation part. Instead, every die that you place in the Sagrada grid ends up placing more restrictions on further dice that you can place in the grid. So it gets progressively harder as the game goes on to draft the die you want and to put it in the place that you want. I prefer Sagrada because it's one of those where I can play a little bit more by intuition and less by having to just constantly do math in my head.
I really like the dynamic that you and I have between Role Player and Sagrada. I think it's really indicative of our differences in the way that we approach math problems, basically.
Yes.
With Role Player, there's a lot of scattered things that you have to all marshal together.
Oh, man.
And with Sagrada, there's
insane.
A single puzzle that you have to math out in your head and figure out the right things to put in the right places, but it's all centralized on your little board.
Yes.
And that's very much representative of the difference between you and me and how we approach problems.
Yes, it is. Let me make a shout out here to another spatial puzzle with dice that I really enjoy, and that's Not Dice.
Sure,
most of the Not Dice games, not all of them, but most of them are in fact spatial puzzles.
And Not Dice is these gorgeous emerald colored shimmering dice with Celtic knot symbols on them from, I think, Black Rock Games.
From Black Oak Games.
Ah, Black Oak Games, my mistake. So that's spatial puzzles with dice. The next thing we're going to talk about is worker placement. So we've talked about Endangered a lot recently.
Yeah, I really like the dice as worker placement in Endangered. It's really neat that you roll your dice at the beginning of your turn, and then you try to figure out where you can possibly place them that will do the most good.
So the thing about Endangered, which is so interesting, is after you roll your dice, the only way that you can put a die on a location as a worker is if that die face is higher than another die face that is on that location.
Higher than any of the dice that are on that location.
Right, any of the dice that are on that. So it progressively builds up and gets harder and harder to use a location until people pick up those dice and reroll them again.
So like most of these locations show three spots. You could actually, in theory, put more than three dice on them. It's just so vanishingly unlikely that you're going to continue to have higher and higher numbers to put more dice on them that it makes it really challenging. But there are other games that use dice as workers in worker placement games. Mm-hmm. Ones I can think of that we've played are Euphoria and, Teotihuacan.
Teotihuacan, where your dice are workers working their way around the board. As they increase in rank, you are manually moving them from 1 to 2 to 3, etc.
Yeah, I don't think you ever roll your dice in Teotihuacan at all. It's just you have workers that start at value 1 or value 3, depending on when you get them. And at various points along the way, you get opportunities to upgrade their power.
Yep. And then when they move all the way to 6, they ascend and you get little awards for that. And then it goes back to 1.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly using the concept of different die faces, but in a completely different way. So that's worker placement. Let's move on to engine building. And one of my favorite games when it comes to just like dice thrashing, dice everywhere, frenetic. Crazy engine building because you're physically building an engine.
This would be Steampunk Rally, wouldn't it?
This is, in fact, totally Steampunk Rally. So Steampunk Rally is a game from Roxley where you are literally building your airship thing and the engine that goes into your airship thing, and all of the different cards that you put into your engine help build an engine, which allows you to roll dice and then allocate dice into parts of the engine, which allow you to pick up extra dice, which allow you to roll those. It's literally an engine builder. And you're racing around a track. It's so much fun. Have you played this game?
I still have not.
Oh my gosh. Oh, we have to play this game and play it soon. It's so much fun. There are over 100 dice in the box. It's just, it's zany. It's silly. You're literally just rolling as fast as you can to get your engine working to do its thing. It's a ton of fun. I love it.
There's another kind of engine building game that uses dice. This would be Dice Forge, where your dice are the engine to get you more resources and more points, and you physically pop faces off the dice and upgrade them.
Yeah, I've never seen a game quite like this. I've seen dice that are used for like prototyping that people will change faces on because they're trying to weight out the dice differently or something like that. But I've never seen a game where the core mechanic of the game is to take the faces off and put new faces on the way the Dice Forge does it. And I love it.
It is really fun. It's a little bit point salad-y in that your dice are the engine to get your resources, but then you're trying to figure out the best way to spend your resources to end up with the most points at the end of the game. So it's this balance between upgrading your engine or just flat out like, oh, but I could just do this thing for points. Maybe I should just do the points now and upgrade my engine later. This is what happened when I played Dice Forge with our son earlier this week. He did a lot of early on, points, points, gold, gold, gold. Oh, maybe I should start upgrading my dice. And I'm like, honey, I have already changed 8 faces of the 12 faces on my dice.
Yeah. So we talked about engine building and dice building. And if you remember way back when we talked about deck builders, we kind of had a difficult time walking the line between engine builders and deck builders. And of course, in that same vein, we can see the same thing in dice with Quarriors, which is essentially a deck builder with dice.
Yeah, so Quarriors, instead of building up an engine of roll more and more dice or make your dice more and more powerful, Quarriors is more like a deck building game in that you're pulling the same amount of dice out of your bag every time. So I guess it's also, you could also look at it as a bag building game. But you are trying to put better dice in your bag to then pull out and roll and do stuff with.
And in pure deck builder fashion, there is the ability in some of the expansions to cull dice out.
Even in the base game, you can cull dice out.
It's errata. It's not in the original base game. Gosh, we've talked about combat games, we've talked about spatial puzzles, we've talked about worker placement, we've talked about engine building and deck slash bag building, we talked about kind of this point salad approach.
What about drafting? We were talking a little bit about drafting with cards, but you can draft dice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can draft dice with like Sushi Roll, for example.
Yeah, I know there are other games out there that do that. There are a couple of games in the not dice series that do. But Sushi Roll is a really good example of dice drafting. You're moving your little conveyor belts around and pulling right. one die off each time.
You know, we're not really going to talk about roll and writes, although those obviously are all using dice as well. But sure. there's a lot of dice drafting in roll and writes.
In roll and writes, sure.
Yeah, that's a very sure. common thing. And the last thing we're going to talk about is push your luck games.
Of course, games like Zombie Dice and Can't Stop, where mm-hmm. the dice are the main mechanic. Do I keep rolling? Do I stop?
And it's not necessarily about, like, a game like Can't Stop. It's really about the numerics on the die faces. A game like Zombie Dice or Batman Dice or, you know, any of those kinds of games, it's about set collection and the risks of collecting the wrong sets.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's just an absolute ton of it. This whole show really started with this idea that we had that we thought dice were the most dynamic element in tabletop games. And we want to know kind of what you think. So if you head over to our Facebook page in the community at thefamilygamers.com/community, you're going to see a poll that we put up mm-hmm. about what do you think the most dynamic element is to use in a tabletop game. And we'll put some suggestions in there, but we'll allow you to add your own suggestions as well.
Sure.
I think we'll include cards because why not? Okay. Obviously, if you can put text on cards, they're pretty darn dynamic.
I mean, I've played enough games with multi-use cards to be reminded that they're really flexible. They can be used in a ton of different ways.
That's true. That's true. So that is our topic this week, talking about dice and how we can use them in games and the fact that they are incredibly flexible. I mean, you may remember from last week's show that we talked about deck building and how we all had these different deck building games that we were playing, and they all approached deck building differently and all this stuff. And that's one type of mechanic that approached one type of thing in a different way. This week, we're talking about dice and all the different ways that you can use dice. What is that dynamic thing? What is that flexible thing in board games? Head over to that poll and weigh in on your thoughts.
All right, that sounds pretty cool. Where are you going to be able to find that poll again?
I'm so glad you asked. You can get there, our Facebook community, by going to facebook.com/groups/familygamersAA, or you can just go to thefamilygamers.com/community. There's a lot of other places that you can find us on social media.
You can find us on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram at familygamersAA.
That's right. Or you can always email us, andrew@thefamilygamers.com.
anitra@thefamilygamers.com.
Please don't forget to subscribe to the show, tell your friends about the show, and leave us a review at Apple Podcasts or whatever your podcast subscription source is. You can also find us on Amazon Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Spotify.
The Family Gamers is sponsored by First Move Financial. Go to firstmovefinancial.com/familygamers to learn how the team at First Move Financial can help you pile up the victory points. Well, I think that's going to be it for us this week.
All right, let's go roll some dice.
Sleeping on piles and piles of dice tonight.
Oh boy, that's like the worst Ouch. Princess in the pea ever.
Little D4 Caltrops.
Please no. No, 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 no. Well, I better hurry up and get to bed first then. So that's going to be it for us this week. Until next week, everybody.
Play games with your kids.